So I don't have a PowerPoint presentation, but there is a handout that should be circulating, I hope, and I hope there are enough copies of it. On the handout, you have mainly examples or citations from people I'm going to quote from. So my talk is about imagination and the self. And as I start with sort of the general points about states with content, like imaginative states. So when I imagine something, there is indeed something which I imagine. And that which I imagine, when I imagine, I call the content of the imaginative episode. And I also believe that the same thing holds for states like perceptions or memories or beliefs. They are all states with content, where the content is a state of affairs that is either imagined to obtain or perceived to obtain or believed to obtain. So we have something that all those states have contents, and that may well be the same contents, but there is a difference in the examples I've just given, the difference between imagining versus perceiving versus believing or remembering is a difference in what Searle calls the mode of the state. So someone who believes that P is in a state with a certain mode, which would be the belief mode, and a certain content, namely the proposition that P. And similarly, someone who desires that P or doubts that P is in a state with arguably the same content but entertained under a different mode, namely doubt or desire. Now, there are a few aspects of this view that are controversial, but I sort of just assume this simplified version with this mode content distinction. Now, what is the mode? I'm not going to spend time on this, but I think that the mode of a state corresponds to its function, its role, what it's for, the role of that type of state in the mental economy. And I also think that the mode of the state determines what counts as success for a state of that type. So I'm not going to define or characterize success, but for epistemic states, such as belief, or in the experiential domain, perception or memory, I take success to come down to veridicality. And I'm going to assume that. And I'm only going to talk about veridical states. I mean, not states whose type of success is veridicality. Now, there is a standard story regarding the relation between the content of an epistemic state, that is, the state of affairs it represents, and the conditions under which it is veridical, which we might call the satisfaction conditions. Satisfaction conditions in a broader notion, it goes beyond veridicality condition, but it's broadly the same thing as what I call the success conditions. And the standard story is what Greg has presented, I think. So if I perceive that P, my perception is veridical on this view, on the standard view, if and only if it is the case that P. So the content of a state is supposed to determine its veridicality conditions in a fairly straightforward manner. There is actually identity between the content and the veridicality conditions. A state represents a given state of affairs. That's the content of the state. And the state is veridical if and only if the state of affairs actually obtains. So that's a simple story, but I don't think it's absolutely right. I think we should actually, that maybe that's what you had in mind, Jerome, in your last question. I think we should draw a distinction between the content and the veridicality conditions. And the reason why we should distinguish them is that I think the veridicality conditions, or more generally, the success conditions or the satisfaction conditions of a given state, depend both on its content and on its mode. So that's the sort of view I hold. So in the case of perception, the content is the scene that is perceived. So now there is a certain scene that I'm perceiving, and you're all part of it. Sorry, yes. But whether or not the perception is veridical depends not merely on whether or not the scene obtains in general, but whether or not it specifically obtains in the subject's immediate perceptual environment. That is, that part of the environment the subject is perceptually sensitive to. So here, for example, I said that I had certain perceptual states. there is a certain scene that I see, but my perceptual state wouldn't be veridical if that scene obtained, if it obtained somewhere else, not right in front of me, but say in Moscow at the present time. That wouldn't make my perception veridical. For my perception to be veridical, what I see has got to obtain, has got to be the case right in front of me. So that's the idea. And that's the veridicality conditions. They import something new, something extra compared to the content proper. Well, the content proper is just what I see, the scene represented by my state. Or to take a different example, an episodic memory is veridical just in case the scene remembered happened in the subject's past and is the causal source of the memory. Again, there is something extra. It's not just what you remember. You remember a certain scene, but it's not enough for your memory to be veridical that the scene actually obtained. It must have obtained in your past experience. If the scene happened, but not in your own experience, not in the subject's experience, as in the famous case of quasi-memory, then that's not enough for the memory to count as veridical. So I think there is an important distinction between the content, in the narrow sense, the state of affairs represented, and the full veridicality conditions which go beyond the content. Well, the content is a certain state of affairs which the state represents. The veridicality conditions of the state consist of a broader state of affairs, of which the state of affairs represented is a proper part. So the idea is that there is the content, which is the state of affairs represented by the state. Say, what I see, what I remember, that's the content. And then there is a broader state of affairs of which this is a part, but there is an extra bit. And that's in the extra bit that the self comes into the picture. So that's the reason why I'm talking about that in this preliminary section. So I hold that memory and perception and many other states are reflexive states, by which I mean that the full veridicality conditions of such states involve the subject of the state. So there is some reflexivity because there is a state, the state has a subject, and if you look at the veridicality conditions of the state, you find that the subject is involved. It is involved as part of what I call the extra bit. So a memory is veridical just in case its content fits an event that took place in the subject's past. So that's the subject's involvement. Subject is involved because the scene that's memorized, for the state to be veridical, it has to have obtained in the subject's past, in the past of the subject of the state. And the perception is veridical just in case its content matches an event which takes place in the subject's immediate environment and appropriately causes the perception. So that's what I said about this example of seeing you. You must be right here in front of me. It's not just enough that you're all together in a room that looks like this one. So in all cases, the subject is involved even if, and that's very important because I'm going to talk about this sort of case, even if the subject is not represented in the content of the state. And I believe that in the examples I gave, that's the case. Here, what I see, I'm not among the things that I see. I see you, I don't see me. So I'm not in the content of the state. I'm not part of the content, but I'm involved as the subject of the state in the extra bit that is constitutive, that is an ingredient in the overall veridicality conditions of the state. So in general, I want to say that the mode of the state is what determines a certain relation R that has to hold between the subject of the state and its content, and the content of the state. So that's a general schema that works for what I call reflexive states. So when the state is reflexive, let me use the blackboard. P is the content of the state, what the state represents. So that's the content of the memory, what you remember, the content of the perception, what you perceive. But the mode determines a certain relation R, which the subject of the state is to bear to the content for the state to be veridical. So veridicality conditions of the state is just this thing, this whole thing. And that's what I call the extra bit, the fact that the subject S bears relation R to P, that's the extra bit. P is the proper part I talked about, what's represented, or the content proper. Of course, the relation R is different. In the case of perception, as I said, the perception is veridical only if I stand in the appropriate contextual relation to the scene, that is, only if the scene, that is the content of the perception, has affected my visual organs and led to the perception. And in the case of memory, it's something similar, but involving time, that is, the content of the state of affairs must have actually caused that state, and it remains as a trace of the state itself is as a sort of trace of the past event that was experienced formally. Okay, so the reason why I'm talking about reflexive states, which have this property that the subject is involved as part of the overall veridicality conditions, the reason why I'm talking about that is that there is an issue whether imagination is a reflexive state. And that's the issue of how the self is involved when you imagine something. And I think that, so the issue is the self, the subject, necessarily involved in his or her imaginations as part of the extra bit, what I call the extra bit, as it is the case for perception or memory? And I think the common assumption is that the answer should be positive. I think that most people would say yes, of course, at least in the sort of case that I'm going to talk about, the cases of subjective imagination. So people would say yes, but I think that's the wrong answer. I think that we should give a negative answer to that question. And to start discussing this issue in connection with the imagination, I'll discuss a well-known passage from Zeno Wendler's paper on, vicarious experience, yes. So you have this nice passage, that's the first one on the handout, I'm going to read it. It's a distinction between two types of imagination that we may call subjective imagination and objective imagination, or perhaps imagination from inside and imagination from outside. And the case we're going to focus on is the case of imagination from inside. That's a subjective case. So there is a correlation with some types of linguistic expression that would be relevant later. So we are looking down upon the ocean from a cliff. The water is rough and cold, yet there are some swimmers riding the waves. Just imagine swimming in that water, says my friend, and I know what to do. Brr, I say, as I imagine the cold, the salty taste, the tug of the current, and so forth. Had he said, just imagine yourself swimming in that water, I could comply in another way too, by picturing myself being tossed about, a scrawny body bobbing up and down in the foamy waste. In this case, I do not have to leave the cliff in imagination. I may see myself, if I so choose, from the very same perspective. Not so in the previous case. If I indeed imagine being in the water, then I may see the cliff above me, but not myself from it. So I hope you see the difference between the two types of the two ways of imagining oneself being in the water. Now, these cases, I call them the subjective case and the objective case of imagination. There is something quite parallel in the case of episodic memory. And one of the things, the very interesting things that Wendler says about those cases is that these two cases, they are really not on a par, because the objective case, the case in which the subject sees himself as an object, like the case in which the subject imagines that he himself is one of those swimmers that he sees. This case, the objective case, according to Wendler, is a special case of the other type of case, of the subjective case. That means basically all imagination, I mean, the two cases are both subjective. But what we call the objective case is the case in which, in addition to what's going on in the other case, there is something more that's going on. So in Wendler's example, the objective case is the case in which the subject imagines seeing himself in the water. So the subject is, in this scenario, actually seeing several people swim in the water over there. And one, the objective imagination, the objective way of complying with the request, imagine yourself being in that water, the objective way is to imagine that instead of simply seeing those people, you actually see those people and yourself among them, or you see those people, but you are yourself one of them. But again, as Wendler says, the perspective is always from the cliff. It's from the cliff that you're looking at the swimmers and seeing them. And in your imagination, you're again seeing them again from the cliff, but you happen to be one of them. So in that special case, the subject plays two roles at the same time. He's not only the experiencer, the person from whose point of view the scene is seen, but he's also an object in the scene. So in that sort of imagination, the subject is both the person from whose perspective the scene is seen or imagined, and is also an object in the scene. And this duality enables the subject to look at himself or herself from an external third-person point of view. In contrast, the so-called subjective case, the case with which Wendler actually starts in his quotation, is the case in which the subject only plays the role of the experiencer. That is, in that case, and to read it again, just imagine swimming in that water, and I know what to do. Brr, I say, as I imagine the cold, the salty taste, the tug of the current, and so forth. That's what's imagined here, is the cold, the salty taste, that sort of thing. So I would say that here the subject is not an object, an aspect of what is represented. What is represented is only those things that just listed, the cold, the salty taste, the tug on the current. What's represented is really what it's like to be in the water. But the subject itself as a swimmer, as an individual, is not represented as it is in the other case, when we imagine that among these people you see there is yourself, one of them is yourself. In this case, what you're imagining is, say, several people, including yourself, swimming in that sea. That's what you see. You imagine that the content of that visual scene that you're not seeing, but merely imagining. So there is this distinction between two cases. In one case, the subject is actually represented as an object in the content of the imagination, not in the other case. But in both cases, the subject is the subject, that is, the experiencer, the person whose perspective is relevant to what's being imagined. Everything is imagined from the subject's perspective, but in addition, the subject may or may not be represented in the content of what's imagined. So as I said, the distinction between the two types, the objective and the subjective type, is not proper to the imagination. It also applies to basic experiential states such as memory or perception. So in the case of memory, terminology that's used is different. People talk about things like field memory or versus observer memory, but that's really the same, I think, the same distinction. So for memory and perception, I said that the subject is involved in the veridicality conditions via the mode which imposes a certain relation R between the subject and the content. But of course, the subject can also be a constituent of content. That is part of what's represented by the state. So that's the extra bit here. That's the content proper, the P, and the subject is always involved, at least if the state is a reflexive state. The subject is always involved as part of the extra bit. The subject must bear P If the state is very equal, that means that the subject bears a certain relation R determined by the mode to the content of the state. But there are two possibilities with respect to the content itself. The subject may actually be represented as part of the content, or it may not. And these two cases correspond to the objective and the subjective case. So all these cases are subjective in the sense that the subject is always involved by the mode. But the subject may or may not be represented in the content. And that's the distinction that Wendler draws between the two cases. So to say that the subject is represented in the content is to say that it's represented as object. Here I'm using the Wittgenstein's terminology. There is also, that's again the same distinction, I believe. Wittgenstein's distinction between two ways of apprehending the self as object or as subject. So let's use his example. I look into the mirror and I see myself with a bump on the forehead. I think that's one of his examples. In this case, that's a clearly objective case. I'm represented, I'm there in the content of what I see. What I see is myself with a bump on the forehead. So the subject is indeed represented in the content. At the same time, of course, the subject is involved as the subject of the perceptual state, the person who's perceiving. That is, that person who has to be suitably related to the represented scene for the state to count as veridical. The subject is both the seer and the CE in this case. You notice that there is in English a word that has only five letters and four of these letters are E's, so that's CE. Okay, there are two cases, and now we need sort of a criteria to tell them apart. I mean, I've used sort of intuitive examples. When the subject is represented as object, there is a possibility of error through misidentification. Something tells me that I'm not going to go through this paper. How much time did I use?
Just 20 minutes.
Well, 20 minutes is half my time, and I'm only on page 3. So that's a problem with not using PowerPoint, but using the written paper. Okay, so I think whenever the subject is represented as object, there is a possibility of error through misidentification. That is, for example, the person in the mirror, even though it's very unlikely, still there is this possibility that the person in the mirror may not be myself. Maybe I made an error. I thought I was seeing myself with that bump on the forehead, but actually someone else was just next to me, and the mirror is strangely inclined or something. But when the subject is only involved as part of the extra bits contributed by the mode, no error through misidentification is possible. I cannot make mistakes as to who is seeing or possibly hallucinating. The scene, that is the content of my perception, that must be me. Similarly, to take a memory example, if I remember walking along the beach with Sylvia in Italy, that's my memory. I may be wrong in many ways. It may not have been Sylvia, but Mary. Or perhaps it was not Italy, but Greece. You know how memory goes. But what cannot happen is that it was not me, but it was someone else. If it's a memory, it's got to have been me. So the possibility of misidentification errors provides evidence that the self is represented as object. I think good evidence. And there is also, in the other direction, there is good linguistic evidence bearing on the distinction between the two types of case. And, I'm afraid that I won't have much time. But you remember that in Wendler's passage, there was this contrast between two ways of asking someone to imagine. Imagine swimming in that water, and imagine yourself swimming in that water. And what Wendler says is that if the request is, imagine yourself swimming in that water, you can do it in two ways, the subjective way or the objective way. But if you ask someone, imagine swimming in that water, then only the subjective way comes as a way of complying with that request. And so I don't want to spend too much time, and that's of course very interesting, but we'll have a problem with time. So I've got another example involving memory of this same contrast. So that's one and two on the handout. He remembers himself delivering a speech to the salesman. That's an example I discussed in Perspectival Thought. Versus he remembers delivering a speech to the salesman. And to see the difference between these two cases, you have to imagine the sort of scenario that I described in the book I mentioned, just mentioned. So suppose the subject, A, was filmed delivering a speech to an assembly of salesmen. The subject retained no memory of that experience, that is, the experience of delivering the speech. The subject completely forgot about that experience. But he saw the film, he saw himself delivering that speech. So he remembers the episode from the film. Now, at this point, there are two possibilities. The subject may have identified himself as the person in the film, or he may not have identified himself. So if the subject has identified himself, has recognized himself in the film, then there are two possibilities. Sorry. Then the memory is, in that case, vulnerable to error through misidentification, because, of course, the subject may have been wrong in identifying himself with the character in the film. It may turn out that it was not himself. And it's also possible that the subject who remembers the scene in the film remembers himself giving the speech, that is, he remembers the scene in the film with himself playing a role, but without realizing that that person giving the speech is himself. So he may remember himself giving the speech, but without realizing that it is himself. So that would be a sort of accidental case of self-representation, very similar to the example that David Kaplan, well-known examples of David Kaplan involving a mirror, and Kaplan thinking his pants are on fire, pointing to the guy in the mirror who doesn't realize he's himself. So that's a thought about himself, but he doesn't realize that it is himself, so that's a sort of accidental self-representation. I think that sentence one, he remembers himself delivering a speech to the salesman, is compatible with the two situations. The situations in which, so in both cases, the subject remembers from the film himself giving a speech, and in one case, he realizes that it was himself, in the other case, he doesn't. And you could report both cases by saying he remembers himself delivering a speech to the salesman. And you could also use that sentence to report the other case in which the subject actually has retained first-person memories of giving the speech and doesn't need the film. He has those memories, he remembers from inside that event. And we could say also he remembers himself delivering the speech to the salesman. So the sentence one doesn't impose any constraints on the sort of episodic memory that's involved here. But that's very different in the case of two. In the case of two, there are very severe constraints. So with two, if we use this sentence, he remembers delivering a speech to the salesman, the accidental interpretation is totally ruled out, as many people have pointed out in the literature. If the subject does not realize that it is himself who gives the speech in the scene he remembers from the film, we will not say that he remembers delivering the speech. We will say he remembers himself delivering the speech, but he doesn't realize it was himself, something like this. But we couldn't say he remembers delivering the speech. He needs to be conscious of having delivered the speech. But there is more. The case in which the subject has identified himself as the character in the film, but still lacks first-person memories of the original experience, that case is also ruled out by sentence two. We would not say he remembers giving a speech to the salesman if what he actually remembers is seeing in the film the character who he takes to be himself delivering the speech to the salesman. We would rather say remembers himself delivering the speech to the salesman. So what's, again, I've spent already too much time on this, but what's common to the two cases which sentence two rules out is that in both cases, the subject views himself from an external or objective point of view.
Sorry, Francois, just clarification.
Yes.
What you're calling sentence two, I think, is written on my sheet as sentence four.
Oh, yeah, because you don't have the handouts. I was referring to the handouts.
Okay, sorry, right. Okay.
And so it's two corresponds to five on your
okay
thing. So in the sort of cases, either accidental or non-accidental, the two cases that are ruled out by two is the case in which the subject sees himself, remembers himself from an external objective observer point of view. As when you remember the film, because of course when seeing the film, he had this, he saw himself as a character on the film from the outside. The subject who remembers himself from the film, whether or not he has identified the character in the film as himself, views himself from outside as a spectator does. In contrast, the subject who directly remembers giving the speech to the salesman, the subject who has retained the first-person memory of the experience itself, of the original experience, not via the film. That person does not view himself or herself from an objective point of view. He or she subjectively remembers what it was like to give the speech. He or she remembers the action from inside. And I think, again, many people have made that point, and I know that some other people, some linguists have sort of criticized it, but still, many people believe that only that interpretation is compatible with the subjectless construction in two, that is, with the elision of the subject, of the overt subject. In an example like two. Okay, so let me summarize so far. For the imagination, just as for episodic memory and perception, there is an important distinction between the cases in which the self, the subject, is involved, is only involved as subject, that's the subjective case, and the cases in which the subject is also represented as object from outside. In which case the subject actually plays two roles, she's both subject and object. And there are different tests for telling apart, so one linguistic test and another one that uses immunity to error through misidentification. Okay, now, from what I just said, it seems to follow that the self is actually involved as part of the extra bit, as much in imagination as it is involved also in perception and memory. It seems to be very similar. The subject is involved as subject, as part of the extra bit, whether or not additionally it is represented as object in the content of the state. So that's what seems to be the case from the examples I gave. And if that's right, then imagination comes out as a reflexive state on a par with perception or memory. That means that there is some relation R in the case of imagination also between the subject and the content. And indeed, the idea that imagination also is a reflexive state is a view that some people hold. So on the handout, you have the quotation from Walton saying exactly that. He says, is imagining from the, we're talking about, we're focusing on the subjective imagination from now on. So we don't have to worry about the case in which the subject is both present as subject and as object. We are looking at the case in which the subject is present as subject, the pure case, the sort of the subjective case, and we are asking, is the subject involved in this case? It seems that obviously yes. It seems that there is no alternative. So that's what Walton says here. He says, is imagining from the inside necessarily imagining about oneself? Yes, I take it. To imagine seeing a rhinoceros, or maybe a rhinoceros, I don't know, is to imagine oneself seeing a rhinoceros, not just to imagine an instance of rhinoceros seeing. Okay? And Walton points out in the rest of the passage that this is very much like memory. To remember giving a speech is to remember oneself giving one, not to remember an instance of the speech being given. And of course, I fully agree as far as memory is concerned. One can only remember one's own experiences. So even if the subject is not represented as object in the content of the memory, still the memory mode imposes that whatever experience is remembered is implicitly ascribed to the subject as a past experience of hers. So there is what Lewis called a sort of self-ascription of the experience that's remembered by the subject who remembers. Of course, as I said already, we can imagine a state of quasi-memory in which we would remember the experience of other people. But of course, that's not how actual memory works. No, so what about the imagination? Walton holds that to imagine effing necessarily involves imagining oneself effing. But again, even though that seems obvious, I'm not convinced. So when I imagine being Napoleon and fighting the Battle of Waterloo, which is an often discussed example, do I necessarily imagine myself fighting the Battle of Waterloo? Me, Recanati. So here, clearly, Walton qualifies is yes. He says, yes, it's necessary myself, but he adds, and that's the next quote from Walton you have here, he says, the notion of the self that figures in imaginings they say, the subjective imaginings, need not be a very rich or full one. The self whom I imagine to be seeing a rhinoceros may be a bare Cartesian eye. And one reason is that imagine being Napoleon. If one imagines being Napoleon, what I imagine really is myself, Recanati, being Napoleon. One problem is that it's just metaphysically impossible. It could not have been Napoleon. So that must be in a slightly different sense that I imagine myself. And that's exactly what Bernard Williams, who actually raised those issues, says in the passage that's very similar to Walton's, except that Williams wants to argue against the view that the self is involved. So here what Williams says about the example of imagining being Napoleon. He says, if we press this hard enough, you also have the quote at the end of the first page, we really readily get the idea that it's not necessary to be in me in this attenuated sense. The sense which is relevant, the sense in which I'm involved, it can be the real me. William says, because it's not just not what I imagine, and also it would be metaphysically impossible. So what he says is that we can perhaps maintain that the self is involved, but provided we say with Walton that it's not the rich or full self involving the empirical properties that I actually have, but something like a Cartesian I, which is what Williams called an attenuated form of the self. And William says, if we press this hard enough, we readily get the idea that it's not necessary to be me in this attenuated sense, that I should have any of the individuating properties that I do have, like this body, these memories, and etc. And for some of them, such as the body, we may think that it's not necessary to have one at all. The limiting case of this progress is the Cartesian consciousness, an I without body, past, or character. And Williams thinks that this is a reductio of the point of view expressed by Walton. Williams thinks that actually it would be better to say that the self is not involved. So you have to think of that there are three characters, according to Williams. There is the person who imagines, the imagining subject. We're talking about the case in which, say, I imagine being Napoleon fighting the Battle of Waterloo. So there is the person doing the imagining. That's the subject. That's me. I'm imagining. And there is Napoleon. He's clearly involved somehow. And then there is this intermediate character, the imaginee, the person who is imagined by me to be Napoleon. And then the issue is, who is the imaginee? And what William says is that if we consider that the imaginee is the imaginer, which is this idea that imagination is a reflexive state, that's basically the view that Walton is defending, if we think that the imaginer is the imaginee, we get the result that what's imagined is metaphysically impossible, unless we sort of weaken this notion of the self and say that the imaginee is not really the empirical self of the imaginer, but more like some sort of Cartesian self that's stripped of its empirical properties. And then, having said that, Williams offers what I take to be, thank you, a refutation of this point of view. Basically, so I'm not going to go through that. It's the next quote on the next page. That's the idea that actually in this situation, the self is not involved because we're simply imagining Napoleon on the battlefield with my conscious self, Cartesian self, and that makes no sense. What William is saying is that this Cartesian self is just a perspective on the world, and Napoleon already had one. And I'm not bringing to him anything because all my empirical properties have been left aside. So actually the best solution, William says, is to do without the imaginee and have only two characters. There is the imaginer, and there is the person to whom the imagined properties are ascribed. And that's Napoleon. What we're imagining is just what it's like to be Napoleon on the battlefield. I'm not involved, really, there are only two characters. So that's William's solution. And if that's right, then there is a quite fundamental difference between basic experiential modes, perception and memory, and imagination. Memory and perception are reflexive states, such that what they represent concerns the remember or the perceiver. The remember and the perceiver stand in some actual world relation R to what the memory or the perception represents. But imagination is different. What it represents need not concern the imaginer. So while in imagination, perception, or memory, I automatically and implicitly self-ascribe the property of being R-related to what is represented, in imagination, no R relation to the imagined scene is imposed by the act of imagining. The real-world connection between the experiencer and what is experienced is suppressed when we turn to the imagination, as a result of which we can imagine state of affairs to which we bear no actual world connection whatsoever. So I can imagine all sorts of things, and again, there need not be any connection to myself. And that features of the that feature of the imagination makes it very similar to quasi-memory. But we're talking about the actual imagination here, while quasi-memory is just a case imagined by philosophers, very different from actual memory. Okay, now, I'd like to, I have only a few minutes left, even though I'm going to take a few more, subtract it from the discussion to actually discuss a sort of paradox that arises from this view. And by the way, this view, I coined the expression, the quasi-dessé for this sort of case. That I've been talking about, the case in which you have a subjective state, like a subjective imagination, which is exactly like the sort of cases that we talked about in the case of subjective memory, the case in which the subject is only involved as subject, but in which it seems that the subject of the point of perspective is not actually that of the person whose state it is. So there seems to be two different subjects in those. Well, anyway, let me not go into what I mean by quasi, they say that is interesting in connection with the literature, but let me simply discuss what I take to be a paradox. So the conclusion we reached on the basis of William's objection to the Cartesian approach, defended by Walton and others, is somewhat paradoxical. And let me spell out why. I said that the self's involvement takes one of two forms. The self may be represented in the content, or it may be involved as subject via the requirements of the mode. In subjective imagination, I said, the subject is not represented in the content. You imagine simply the experience, what it's like, but you're not yourself represented in the content. Only features of the experience are represented, not the experiencer. And I said also that the subject of the state, that is the imaginer, may be, in some cases, the person to whom the experience is implicitly ascribed in imagination, so you imagine what it would be like for you to be in that world. But I also argued that it need not be. The imagined experience may well be the experience of someone else, not the imaginer. It may be the experience of Napoleon or the experience of the swimmers. And that's what I call the quasi-dessé type of imagination. It's not really dessé because the imagining subject is not really involved, even though there is something first-personal about this type of imagination. And that's the paradox. The paradox is the subject is not represented in the content of the imaginative experience. Okay, that's what's common to all subjective cases in the narrow sense. But here, the subject is not the target of the imaginative state either. That is, the subject, the imagining subject, is not the person to whom the imagined experience is implicitly ascribed. Rather, the person to whom the imagined experience is implicitly ascribed is Napoleon. So the paradox is that quasi-dessé cases like this one, the case in which we imagine from inside what something would be like, or what it's like for those swimmers, or for Napoleon to do certain things, there are cases of subjective imagination or imagination from inside that are exactly like the cases that Wendler talks about when you imagine swimming in that water. You imagine how cold it would be and things like that. And subjective imagination in general, or imagination from inside, has a first personal feel which is quite unmistakable, even if it is theoretically elusive. And my question now is, in the last couple of minutes, what is this first personal feel if the subject is not involved at all, neither in the content nor in the extra bit, which is what I'm saying now. I'm saying that the, The imagining subject is not there at all in some cases, namely the dese cases. And that shows that imagination by itself, qua mode of, does not impose an R relation between the subject and the content. Any theorist who, like myself, allows for the existence of quasi-dese cases like this owes an explanation of why subjective imagination has the first personal feel it undoubtedly has. And so I'm going to go very fast, but it's also a very intuitive explanation, I think, so it doesn't... one doesn't need to... No, that's okay, I'm almost done. Yeah, sure. So I think the explanation should take the following form. I spoke of perception and memory earlier as basic experiential states. And the reason to speak that way is that I think that there are states that are not basic in that sense, and what I have in mind is precisely the imagination. Imagination is not basic. It has a secondary or derived character. That strikes me as absolutely obvious, but maybe not everybody would agree. So I think that imagination is not even something homogeneous. There are many different things under the imagination. But imagination in general should be construed as a simulation of a primary state. So the primary states are possibly the basic states. Well, that's really not exactly true, but... Okay, so we have to think of imagination as always having a secondary character. It's always the stimulation of something else. It's not like perception or memory, which are basic states. And indeed, the primary states that imagination simulates may be a perception, maybe a memory, maybe a belief, a desire, an intention, an action, an emotion, whatever. And it may also be a complex state with such states as constituents. Now, all these states, whether simple or complex, I think, can be simulated in imagination. Now, the important thing, which provides the key to my solution to this apparent paradox, is that reflexive states themselves can be simulated. Indeed, I've just given examples on my list. Some of the states are reflexive states. Reflexive states can themselves be simulated, and I take it that's what the quasi-dese is. The quasi-dese is the simulation of a reflexive state. So the first personal character of quasi-dese states, which is paradoxical because in those states, it seems that the subject of the state is not there in the content, it's not there in the extra bit. Where is it if it's first personal? Indeed, it's not there, but the whole state, the quasi-dese state, is the simulation of a reflexive state. And at the level of the reflexive state that is being simulated, there is the reflexivity. That is, the subject of the reflexive state is there in the veridicality or whatever success conditions of the state. It's involved in the extra bit. But that's at the level of what is simulated. If you look at the imagination state itself, which is the simulation of the other state, at the level of the imagination state, you don't have the reflexivity because the subject, the imagining subject, is not there in the... Again, you find the reflexivity at the prior level. And because the reflexivity and the first personal character are closely tied together, that gives the first personal feel to the state that is the simulation of the reflexive state. So that's basically my solution, and the paradox evaporates. Thanks, and stop here.